The following podcast is an exclusive presentation of Project Entertainment Network.
Three guys with beards.
The Project Entertainment Network store, featuring t-shirts, mugs, stickers, hoodies, and more from your favorite Project Entertainment Network podcasts.
Inkstains, Scribbler's Rest, 13 o'clock.
The Horror Show with Brian Keane.
Why not show your loyalty by wearing a cool product from the podcast group and show off to your friends?
It Cooks.
Armcast.
The Mondo Method.
Monster Attack.
Necrocasticle.
Go to projectentertainmentnetwork.com and click on the store tab for more details.
The Liars Club Podcast.
Bizarre.
The Lunch Ladies Book Club.
Matters of Faith.
The Project Entertainment Network store, stacked with stuff from the best podcasts on the internet.
The Curtain Jerkers.
Buttercup of Doom.
www.projectentertainmentnetwork.com.
Hey everybody, welcome to this week's episode of Monster Attack, the podcast dedicated to old monster movies. Now, a little bit of an interesting story behind the movie that we're going to be talking about this week. And it's one I'm a little red-faced about, because a few weeks ago we did a film called It Came From Beneath the Sea, one of my favorites as a kid growing up. And after that, the release of that episode, a number of people contacted me and said, hey, you know, after, you know, listening to It Came From Beneath the Sea, why don't you consider doing Beast from 20,000 Fathoms? Well, I erroneously told a few of them, I said, well, we've already done that. If you look at, I think it's around the first season or so, we did a show on Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. Now, we have been, for those of you that are new to Monster Attack, this is our third season. We're nearing the end of our third season. In February of next year will be the fourth anniversary of the podcast. And I could have sworn that during the time that Mark Maddox was a regular co-host on the show, he at one time in the first season, he appeared every single week, and then his schedule prevented him from doing it with that much regularity. Now we get Mark, you know, once or twice a month. I remember vividly talking about something to do with Beast from 20,000 Fathoms during one of our podcasts. Well, I got in touch with Mark, and he said, no, we have not done that show unless you've done it on your own. And sure enough, when I checked, after one of the listeners said, I've checked all of your episodes, and there isn't one for Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. Sure enough, there wasn't one. And I think, you know, I got sort of curious how this got so fixed in my mind that we had done this one before. And it went back to a film that we talked about, an old Roger Corman film called It Conquered the World. And in that movie was an early appearance from actor Lee Van Cleef. And we made reference to Lee Van Cleef's appearance in this movie that we're talking about tonight, Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. And I think that's where I got a little mixed up. So anyway, my apologies to those of you that I said, no, we've done this, and you've went on the search for trying to find an episode that didn't exist. So we're going to do it now. And it's sort of appropriate. It sort of worked out really well, because not only is this coming on the heels of us doing It Came From Beneath the Sea, a film that actually came out 2 years after this movie, but also Beast from 20,000 Fathoms is a film that greatly influenced the producer of Gojira, a film that Madeline and I talked about last week. So it just all sort of seems to fit in a nice little monster movie type world. Now, this one also, I want to go off on a little bit of a tangent here talking about this particular film, because I noticed something sort of interesting that was going on as I was getting prepared to do this podcast. Now, you know, for those of you that are new to Monster Attack, this will come as news to you. But those of you that have been listening to it regularly, I apologize for some of the repetition here, in that Monster Attack is a lot of my recollections and the memories I have of what these films did for me and to me and how they influenced me as a kid growing up, because these were the first really substantial films that I got interested in as a kid. I was in first grade when I saw my first monster movie, coincidentally, a film very similar to the one we're going to talk about tonight, The Giant Behemoth. And you've heard me speak many times about how The Giant Behemoth was the first movie I ever saw. Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, I saw not long after I saw The Giant Behemoth, as I was really, really getting into it. And of course, you know, we've talked about this on several episodes, how for some of us, when we got introduced to these films, how incredible it was that we found this genre. And for me personally, it opened the door for me to really get into all kinds of film genres and become an actor and also become a film director and writer. And it greatly influenced the person who I am today. So for all of the naysayers back in the 50s and the 60s, and it's even some today, you know, the parents who think, oh, if I expose my children to these films, it'll warp them forever. There's a lot of us folks and a lot of you that I correspond with on a regular basis who grew up on these films, and we turned out okay. In fact, we grew up with a different kind of appreciation for the films that are out there to be watched. I really owe every interest that I have in the film industry to monster movies. Now, where am I going with this real quickly? And I'm going to do this quickly so that I don't cut in too much into our discussion on Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. I realized just not too long ago, as I had a chance to revisit The Giant Behemoth, It Came from Beneath the Sea, and now Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, that my memories as a kid about some of these films for many, many years sort of overlapped more than one movie. So when I used to have fond memories of The Giant Behemoth, and for a while there, it was a little hard to find that film. There was just a little bit of an area before the advent of VHS tapes and then some of these films getting re-released on VHS where it was a little difficult to find these kind of movies. You know, you had the little 8mm films that you could buy, but they didn't have one for Giant Behemoth, you know, where I lived. And finally, I bought a copy of The Giant Behemoth, I guess it was in the mid-80s, you know, as I was starting my film collection, which was, I would say, 80% monster movies. And then, watching that film for the first time in, I would say, about 20 years, I realized there were some things different about it that I didn't remember as a kid. A lot of those things that I was puzzled about, thinking, wow, my memory of The Giant Behemoth was totally different now as an adult than it was as a kid, because that film greatly affected me. It made me want to watch every monster movie ever made, you know, in the world. Some of those scenes that I was associating with The Giant Behemoth were really scenes from the movie we're going to talk about tonight, Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. And they're very similar. I mean, you've got a giant dinosaur that is awakened because of nuclear testing. And in both cases, you've got this giant prehistoric creature going on a rampage through a contemporary city. Of course, this was, Giant Behemoth came out a year after this film in 1954. And of course, this film came out in 1953. So we will say Beast from 20,000 Fathoms will sort of hold the mantle as being the first film to really influence a lot of these big dinosaur type films that would come out in the 50s and the 60s. And of course, in this film, we also get a chance to talk for the first time, or the film people get a chance to really see for the first time the talents of Ray Harryhausen, and who studied under Willis O'Brien. I probably mistakenly said a few weeks ago that it came from Beneath the Sea, or one of them was one of the first movies. I was talking about Gojira, I think, too, as well. The first big monster movies. And, you know, I want to stand corrected on that, because that really should be in the purview of a film we talked about several months ago, King Kong. I mean, that was really the first big monster film. And of course, you know, Willis O'Brien did the incredible work on that. And Harryhausen studied under Willis O'Brien. So I know I'm going all over the map on this thing, but it's just interesting how much I confused as a kid you know, especially in high school and then early college years, when it was hard to find these films, how much I confuse some of the scenes from this film and the giant behemoth. And as we get into the storyline, I'll tell you some of those scenes a little bit, because, you know, in Giant Behemoth, he went on a rampage in a little bit different way. And of course, the giant behemoth was more concerned with the dangers of the radiation that he absorbed as he made his way towards modern day society, because the giant behemoth sort of breathed out a radioactive stream, very similar to what Godzilla did, or Gojira. You know, they both had that in common. They would breathe out this breath that would be, you know, absolutely devastating to mankind. Our monster tonight didn't do that, but he's going to be deadly in a different way. And like I said, when we get into the storyline a little bit, we'll talk in detail a little bit more about that. So an interesting thing, fact that this didn't really become apparent to me until just a few months ago, when I realized, wow, I kept thinking that was a scene from the Giant Behemoth. It was really from this one, and vice versa. So it's funny, at an early age, you know, the influence that these films have on you, and then some of the memories you have on them. And when you get amongst other people who have a similar interest, you can see how your memories get a little colored over the years. Because, I mean, literally every Saturday afternoon and evening that I spend as a kid growing up, I'm watching monster movies, like a lot of us were, because, I mean, that was like the highlight of our life. So anyway, I've gone on and on now for a little more than 10 minutes. Let's get into Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. Well, we told you that the Beast itself is another, you know, brilliant piece of stop motion animation from Ray Harryhausen. The guy, I mean, he is a legend. And I don't know what else I could say about Ray that I haven't said in previous podcasts. One of my favorites. I mean, you know, when you've got Seven Voyages of Sinbad and Jason and the Argonauts, and then, you know, Guanji and all of these other great, great films that involve some magnificent stop motion animation. And Harryhausen, as we mentioned last week, was considered, they were considering hiring him for Gojira, but they didn't have the money to do it. They did not have the money to afford the stop motion animation type procedure. And there was no one in Japan that did it as well as Ray Harryhausen. And that's why they went with a guy in a suit type monster. It would have been a whole different movie if you had stop motion animation in that film. So we've got Ray Harryhausen's definite touch on this film and some of the great miniatures and things that he had to build for this film. We talked a little bit about, you know, how good he was at doing that when we talked about It Came From Beneath the Sea, a film that he would come back and work on 2 years after this one at a much smaller budget. So he had a little bit better budget to work on with Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. Now, just on a little technical note, I just got to throw this in because I think it's sort of a kick for those of us that are sort of geeks. 20,000 Fathoms is about the equivalent, and again, give or take a little bit, you know, I didn't pull my calculator out, but we're talking about like 26 miles. If this thing was 26 miles down in the sea, well, unfortunately, the sea doesn't quite go down that far. It would work better if we're talking outer space, but in the sea only goes down about 5 or 6 miles. So, you know, but it does paint a great picture as a title for the film. Just one of the little goofs that you'll see in this movie. But I'll tell you what, as a kid, I loved this film. I absolutely loved this film. Okay, so let's talk about some of the people that you're going to meet in Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. So let's start right with our male lead. And we've got a couple of big leads in this, and a very familiar face to monster movie fans. But the first one, Paul Habschmidt. Sorry, Paul, I just destroyed your name. A Swiss actor who did a lot of films here in the United States, but is probably known the best for Beast from 20,000 Fathoms among American audiences. Most of the other films that he did were in Germany or in Europe, but he plays our lead guy, Professor Tom Nedsmith. Now, Paul Habschmidt is not the name that you're going to see on the title card in this film. He performed in the United States under the name of Paul Christian. And again, when you see him, you'll recognize him from several films, in the United States, but none more recognizable than what he did here in Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. A very, very versatile actor that acted well into the late 60s. Now, Paula Raymond plays our female lead. And of course, as you would expect, she and Paul get sort of attached to one another, you know, because this is what happens in films from the 1950s. And Paula Raymond, very attractive lady. She was in Hawaiian Eye. She was in several sword and sorcery type films and had quite a career. And the thing that I always got a kick out of is that she and I share the same birthday, not the same year, but the same day. She was born 30 years, exactly 30 years before I was born. And she acted right up until the early 1990s. In fact, her last film came 10 years before she passed away. She lived until she was 79 years old. I can only hope that I can live as long myself. And Paula's character, Lee Hunter, plays the assistant to a big paleontologist from New York, played by an actor that a lot of us remember growing up, Cecil Kellaway. And Cecil was just a great personal type actor. I mean, just he was like a kind old man in every film he played. He played in Harvey. He played in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner? I Married a Witch. I mean, you know, just some amazing films. And he had that great screen persona. In this, he plays Professor Thurgood Elson, who is the big paleontologist who's going to sort of help everybody decide what kind of dinosaur this is that is threatening mankind. Now, our other male lead is Kenneth Toby. And of course, we just talked about Kenneth because he will appear 2 years after this in It Came From Beneath the Sea, playing a very similar part, except this time he's in the Army and not in the Navy. Of course, you remember in It Came From Beneath the Sea, he was a submarine commander. In this, he's an Army commander of an Arctic outpost where they're conducting nuclear testing. And again, right in the beginning of this film, in fact, it's even in the trailer that was released for this film in 1953, we're talking about the fear of nuclear power. Has man discovered something that maybe he shouldn't have discovered, knowing too much about, you know, power in the universe? And, you know, Kenneth, he is one of my favorite actors. As I've said many times before, if I saw that he was in a film, I knew I was going to at least like his character. Might not like the movie, but I mean, he was in everything, it seemed like, that I grew up watching during this time period. He plays Colonel Jack Evans. He follows the dinosaur's trail as it makes its way from the Arctic to New York City. And then one I want to mention, Donald Woods. We haven't talked about Donald Woods in quite a long time, but most people who are into monster movies from this time period will remember Donald Woods for 13 Ghosts. He's the father. Very likable guy. In this one, he plays a captain in the Coast Guard, Captain Jackson, who helps them track down where this dinosaur is going. Yeah, I'm sort of giving a storyline as we go along. And, of course, we mentioned Lee Van Cleef at the beginning. He will appear at the very end of this film, and I'm going to save Lee for the very end. There's a lot of people in here, though, that you're going to see that you'll recognize. One by the name of Ross Elliott, who plays a professor by the name of George Ritchie. Unfortunately for Ross, he gets killed very early in the film. He is one of the first victims of the dinosaur when it wakes up from this nuclear explosion. Michael Fox plays a doctor in this film, and you'll recognize him from several films from this area. He also appeared on a couple of times on The Adventures of Superman. And he is the actor that forced Michael J. Fox to put the J in his name, because at the time Michael J. Fox was joining the union, joining the Screen Actors Guild, he couldn't take on the name Michael Fox because it was tied up by this guy. So he had to put the Michael J. to it. Just a little bit of extra trivia. And then another guy you're going to see, a lot of interesting faces that you'll see as cameos in this film, King Donovan, who we've talked about quite a lot. And another, King Donovan was another real favorite of mine as a kid watching monster movies. And of course, I always remember him from the film Invasion of the Body Snatchers, which we talked about during, I think it was our 100th episode. And I mean, he was just one of those likable guys. He was in ghost movies. He was in all kinds of things. And he was just a very, very likable character. He plays a psychiatrist by the name of Dr. Ingersoll in here for when Tom Nesmith gets injured after spotting the dinosaur in the Arctic, and he is brought in to see if this guy's crazy or not. And of course, there's a lot of things that, you know, we talk about some of the influence society has on how these films were made. Now, this film was based on a story that was written by Ray Bradbury. Now, they had written the script first, and somebody who worked on the production wanted to have Ray, who was a very established author in the 1950s, and had written a short story a few years earlier for the Saturday Evening Post, which comes to figure into this film, because this guy, you know, gives it to Ray and says, Can you look at the script, see what you think? You know, we would like to get your advice on anything we can change. We'll bring you in as a story consultant or whatever. And Ray says, you know, there was a scene in this film involving a lighthouse that gets destroyed by the dinosaur. And he says, this is very similar to something I wrote for the Saturday Evening Post called Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. Because originally the working title of this was something else. And so the producers, sort of took a step back and decided to have Ray Bradbury come in and really help them with this story. So the story is a little bit closer to the one that Bradbury wrote, and he gets a screen credit in here as one of the writers for the film. So, and again, if you're a Ray Bradbury fan, that I think that may be one reason you might be drawn to this film a little bit. Couple of other people you're going to see in here that you'll recognize. Another doctor played by an old character actor by the name of Frank Ferguson. Very, very familiar face from films from this time period and early TV. And another one who we'll see in a few sort of low-budget films for a while before he makes it big on the Dukes of Hazzard, and that's James Best. And he's right in the very beginning of this as a radio operator in the Arctic Post, where this all starts. You've got Kenneth Toby and James Best and a few other people. They're at this very cold outpost. It reminds me a lot of The Thing from Another Planet, because, you know, it's just north of the Arctic Circle, and they're exploding a hydrogen bomb and testing on it. Now, you know, folks, again, this gets back to what I was saying about how society really affected how a lot of these movies were made. Radiation, nuclear bombs, and it wasn't just atomic bombs. Now at this point, they had just discovered the power of the hydrogen atom, of the hydrogen bombs, which made the atomic bomb look like a firecracker, and that's what they're exploding here. And they're using some stock footage of some of the H-bomb testing that actually went on in the Arctic. There's a little bit of stock footage in this that's mixed in very well with the studio work that they have to do. And that's one of the pluses in this film, and the money well spent, the $210,000 that was well spent. This film returned $5 million on its first release, so their investors did pretty well on it. This bomb wakes up this creature, which was frozen suddenly, and this is all explained by a theory that Tom Nesmith has when he sees this creature. As I was saying, Ross Elliott's character gets killed when they're out there getting research done on this thing. But think about, you know, what's happening during this time period. You've got scientists who are and military who are thinking, we can test all of these nuclear weapons up in the Arctic. We won't hurt anybody. There's nobody up there. Think about that now in relation to the ecological studies we have done today and the influence that the Arctic caps have on our weather nowadays. You know, we have a melting ice cap right now because the climate has been heating up and some of the extreme weather conditions that we've experienced in the last 10 or 20 years. That kind of thing now would make scientists just absolutely freak out if we were still doing that sort of thing, which is why nuclear testing was sort of, for the United States and for Russia, they agreed not to do it anymore as of the early 70s. Because of the impact it had on the planet. Again, these radiation things really figured into this. And there's a little bit of a discussion about it early on in the film. Well, we have this creature that has been estimated to be 100 million years old that's woken up, and it goes on the loose. And, of course, nobody believes Tom, who's the first one to really see it and live, while he's in the hospital, but he discovers a couple of newspaper stories about ships that have been destroyed. And we see the ship, one of the ships, get destroyed. And then we see this lighthouse also get destroyed as the creature's making his way down the Arctic stream. And just following this nice little progression down as he's heading towards what we find out where he used to live, or where most of these creatures, these dinosaurs, used to live in the, you know, in caverns where now the Hudson River is. We find all that out. And again, I'm going to be skipping over a lot of the specifics of the stories in here, because this film this week is more one that just the feelings it created for me. As a kid, I loved these big dinosaur movies on, you know, dinosaurs on a rampage type movie. So, you know, finally, Tom is believed, because you have these strange incidents where there were a couple of survivors from one of the shipwrecks, and everybody thinks they're crazy, but Tom is able to get one to believe him, say, look, we believe you. I believe you. I saw this too. And they go and meet with Professor Elson, who it takes some doing, but he finally gets him to believe that maybe this creature does exist, because both Tom and this the seaman who survived the shipwreck, that the creature eating up his fishing vessel, they both identified this same sketch. They take all these sketches of dinosaurs, and both Tom and this other guy pick the same one, said, this is the thing I saw. So Professor Elson is like, yeah, maybe there is something to this. And then they hear about the lighthouse, and then there's a wreckage that washes up on the shore of Massachusetts, and other strange occurrences and things that people missing and that sort of thing. And they're able to just pinpoint it from each little incident that this creature is following that stream from the Arctic right down to the Hudson River. So that leads our Professor Elson to say, you know, now he's excited. I mean, this dinosaur, I mean, my God, first chance to discover a dinosaur in contemporary times. This is a big thing. And he gets the military, our friend Donald Woods, who plays our Captain Jackson, who in the Coast Guard, arranges for him to get a diving bell. Now, remember, folks, in 1953, if you're going to do any kind of deep sea work, you're going to do it in a bathysphere, a bathyscape, or a big diving bell. Because we didn't have submarines that could go down to the depths these guys were going to go down. So they get this diving bell, and Professor Elson goes in with this other Navy guy who's with him, and they go down this big cavern. Now, the set on this is sort of cool. I mean, as a kid, I thought it was sort of cool. It's not very scientific and not very realistic, but it conjures up a lot of the great memories of images from Jules Verne. And some of those great authors, you know, but especially Jules Verne, because he wrote about things under the sea and in outer space and stuff. And this is the kind of thing, the pictures that I saw when I read 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. This is the kind of thing I loved about this film. You could tell that, you know, my mind's just racing a mile a minute when I'm trying to think of how to express myself for these particular emotions. While they're down in this diving bell, they see the monster. And unfortunately, the monster sees them, and the two of them are killed. The monster demolishes the diving bell. And still, one of the things that I find very interesting about this film, and again, this reflects a lot on the way things were back then, the military doesn't want to tell anybody about it. So you see this big front page paper that, you know, a famous scientist killed in diving accident, but nobody knows he was eaten by a dinosaur that's roaming around the Hudson River right near New York City. And of course, what happens? He shows up. He shows up in Brooklyn at the Brooklyn shipyards and the piers down there. And then we have our first, you know, first inkling of the monster, you know, rampaging through New York. Now, the one thing about this film that really struck me, a lot of the films that would come after this would leave the monster to your imagination until you're about a third of the way into the movie. This movie, you see the dinosaur within 5 to 10 minutes of the movie starting. And that was something as a kid that I thought was pretty cool. We got to see the monster right off, and we weren't disappointed. It was some great Ray Harryhausen work. And this is a cool dinosaur. It really is. And it looks very good, very, very realistic for the time period. Again, put your 50s filters on, because remember, we don't have CGI back then. And this was This was like some of the state-of-the-art stuff that they did back then. Well, the monster makes his way into Brooklyn, and of course, the military meets him hands-on. There's one scene I always remember about this, and this was not a scene that I confused with the giant behemoth, and that is one sole policeman. He's almost in shock, but he's walking very slowly amongst all these cars that have been deserted as people just jumped out of their cars and ran for dear life as this thing is wandering around Brooklyn, New York. And he just very calmly, it's a very poignant scene, walks very calmly down the street, pulls out his revolver, and starts firing at it, as if that's going to do anything to this monster. And of course, while he's reloading his revolver, boom, he gets eaten. And I mean, you know, he is grabbed, the monster grabs him by the head, lifts him up, and he's screaming, and his legs are, you know, whatever. It's a brutal scene for a kid that age, and something on TV in the 60s, I'll tell you. You know, that was pretty rough stuff. I'm surprised it survived the censors on that. And we watch him getting eaten right there, right then and there. And that's one of those films that, or one of those scenes in a movie that as a little kid, you go, oh, that was so cool. Now we've got the monster stomping around, and the first thing he does is he stomps and flattens a car. Now that's the scene that I swore as a kid I saw in the giant behemoth, but the giant behemoth didn't do that. So I mean, this is one of the few times that I would mix up something that I saw in one of the movies for the other. Now the military meets him head on and they fire and they chase him off, but they don't kill him. So they know he's out there. They've got to figure out how they're going to kill this monster because he's gone back into the water and disappeared for a while. They figure in this this cave where they figure these monsters used to hide out, but they know he's going to come back because he's got to eat. But this is one of the coolest things about this movie that some of them didn't touch on. As the military is investigating where this monster may have gone following his trail, there's these big patches of blood where they obviously hurt him with the cannon fire and the bazooka fire. And all of a sudden, these soldiers start falling out because there's a disease in the blood. This is a 100 million year old dinosaur, and it's carrying a bacteria or whatever, a virus that mankind has never seen. And it's killing people. You know, the doctor's saying, look, we've got to stop this. We've got a problem here. This blood is contagious. And if we blow this thing to kingdom come, pieces of it are going to fly all over the place and we're going to infect all of New York City. And it might become unlivable. So now they got to figure out how they're going to kill this thing. And that's when Tom decides, I meant to say, he's not a paleontologist. He doesn't know anything about dinosaurs. He's a nuclear physicist. That's why he was up in the Arctic. And he goes, we can kill it with a radioisotope. And he says, I've got one in my lab that will do the job. If we can fire it into the wound of the creature, it will also destroy all the diseased tissue. It should destroy. Yeah, it's basically like radiation treatment for cancer is what we're talking about here. And that leads up to one final confrontation where the beast decides he wants to have a little fun. That's all I can assume. Because he shows up on Coney Island, even though it's actually an amusement park in Long Beach, California. But I gotta hand it to him. They did a pretty good job of making it look like Coney Island. And the monster ends up at the roller coaster, of course, and he's eating the roller coaster, not looking too happy. I guess the roller coaster didn't taste very good. But this is where we meet Lee Van Cleef, because Tom says, hey, look, we need a sharpshooter. We need someone good, because we only have one shot at this. I mean, this isotope isn't something we have a lot of. This is it. We got one sample and we got to make it good. And they load it into a grenade that's going to be fired from a rifle grenade launcher. And Lee Van Cleef says, yeah, I can do it. And they can't get a clean shot from the ground. So they have to go up on a roller coaster and get up on one of the upper crests of the roller coaster. See, I couldn't do that. I'm scared of heights. I could not do that at all. That would just be too much. But to make a long story short, Lee Van Cleef has his shot, aims it, and nails it, nails the beast right in his wound. And he falls down, and not only does it kill the monster, but while he is sort of thrashing around a little bit as this isotope is starting to do its job, he sets the place on fire. And, of course, this is an old wooden roller coaster that goes up like a tinderbox. And that serves the purpose of not only burning the monster up, but destroying all of the diseased tissue. Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. This was one that I saw after the Giant Behemoth, even though it came out the year before the Giant Behemoth. But this film had such an influence, not only back then on the type of big, big monster movies that would come out. Like I said, it did influence the Japanese producers of Gojira, who in 1954, well, actually, they would start working on Godzilla in 1953 for a 1954 release. And then I'm sure this film had a big influence on the Giant Behemoth and the whole nuclear influence, because the Behemoth also dealt with a monster that was created from nuclear testing and some of the influence. Now, in this film, this monster is not radioactive. Behemoth and Godzilla, Gojira, they were both radioactive. So that's one of the distinct differences between the two films. But I got to tell you, folks, as a kid growing up, I would think of all three of these films very similarly, even though I saw Godzilla much later. I was probably closer to junior high age when I finally had a chance to see Godzilla. But Beast from 20,000 Fathoms and Giant Behemoth, I definitely mixed up quite a bit, as I was saying earlier, with different scenes, because, you know, the monster stomping through New York and all that. But some great images. There's scenes I haven't even mentioned from this film that are just very poignant and very memorable. And if you have not had a chance to see this one, especially if you're a Ray Harryhausen fan, I would recommend, you've got to see Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. It is one of the better films from this time period that came out dealing with big monsters. And Ray Harryhausen would go on to do some amazing work. And of course, I think one of the culmination of some of his work with big dinosaurs and things of that nature would be in Valley of Guanche in the later on in the mid-60s. Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. Hey, folks, I want to remind you also that coming up in just a couple of weeks from this podcast's debut, I will be appearing at Monsterama 2018 down here in the Atlanta area in Alpharetta, Georgia, along with Mark Maddox will be there and Madeline Brumby. So if you want to meet all of the folks from the Monster Attack family in one place, you can do it October 5th, 6th, and 7th in Alpharetta at the Marriott down there. And we would love to see you. I'm going to have the distinct honor of getting to interview Luciana Paluzzi from The Green Slime. And we did a show on The Green Slime in our second season. Check it out. If you're going to be at Monsterama, you might go back and check out the Green Slime episode, because they will be showing the film The Green Slime there at Monsterama. So really looking forward to that October 5th, 6th, and 7th. Also, folks, I want to remind you again, we're always having sales and things at our Project Entertainment Network store. If you want to get a Monster Attack t-shirt, or maybe you want to get a Monster Attack coffee cup to start your day with, or all kinds of things like a Monster Attack pillow or a beautiful hoodie or socks, even socks, oh, we've got it all up there at the Project Entertainment Network store. Visit it the next time you're up to check out one of the episodes of the show. Might find some good gifts up there and things. And it really helps us out. It keeps this podcast going. And we would love to see some fans now and then walking around with some Monster Attack stuff. That would be really cool. But the Monster Attack store at the Project Entertainment Network site. That's projectentertainmentnetwork.com. Back with you again next Monday for another episode of Monster Attack. Folks, have a great week, and we will see you then.
Once upon a time, a madman, poet, and thief known as John Urbansick, that's me, challenged himself, myself, to write a story a day, every day, for a year, by hand. Some of them worked. Some of them failed. Some of them were spectacular. Then I did it again. Join me every week for Ink Stains as I do it a third time, and I will read you some of these stories. I'll talk about the process, about creativity in general, writing in specific, and maybe I can help ignite your artistic adventures.
The
This has been an exclusive presentation of the Project Entertainment Network.